It's a beautiful, beautiful day out, so I think there might be people out and about enjoying the beautiful, beautiful day. But for anyone who's never been here before, we're a secular congregation here to celebrate the one life that we know that we have. Welcome to Sunday Assembly, improv style. Our motto here, live better, help often, wonder more. So, today we're going to be discussing autism and autism spectrum disorders. And so, in kind of preparation for that, I read Temple Grandin's book called Thinking in Pictures, which is a collection of essays. And for those of you who don't know Temple Grandin, she's kind of an autism spokesperson. She has autism. She designs cattle handling facilities for her profession. And at this point, the majority of cattle handling facilities in the United States were designed by Temple. And so she is famous and very accomplished in that respect, but also has autism, and so has been able to articulate pretty well what that's like and give a lot of awareness to people with autism and, you know, how they function and different types of autism. So I read her book, and it was fantastic. Something that she did for me better than anyone else I've worked with is really helped me put myself in the shoes of someone with autism, specifically trying to imagine what it would be like from a sensory point of view, because something that can happen with people who are autistic is just your processing of light, of sound, of touch just doesn't happen correctly in the brain. And so, you know, she did a wonderful job of helping me imagine how chaotic and, you know, incomprehensible the world could be if the light that I was seeing looked totally different than it does to me now. Also, Temple has another book called The Animal Book. Does anyone know? Now I'm blanking on the title of her book.
Is it Animals in Translation?
Animals in Translation. Thank you very much. So she talks about how, like, she feels like she can really understand animals because something about the autistic brain is very much like an animal brain in terms of processing. So I threw this in here. So far, I've taught them to let me out and feed me, but I'm still working on get out of my chair. So with that, I will present our speaker, Shannon Hammer. She's an educational and behavioral consultant and a professional counselor. She has over 20 years of experience working with individuals on the autism spectrum and their families. She's currently working with Imagine a Child's Capacity, where she provides training and consultation to schools, community members, and parents. Sharon has co-authored two books and DVDs about using technology to support individuals with autism, entitled Lights, Camera, Autism, which I know colleagues of my husband's have seen and used with their son. With Star Cinema, Sharon co-created the first sensory-friendly moviegoing experience in the state of Wisconsin. Sharon is committed to increasing awareness and possibilities throughout the community for individuals on the spectrum. Please help me welcome Sharon.
And thank you for the warm welcome. I would love this presentation to mean as much to all of you as possible. So in doing that, I just think if I am talking and you have a question about something or something I'm saying is really ringing true, please just speak up. We are a small group today. We can absolutely do that. Thank you. Is that better?
Absolutely.
Okay. Good. Because we're such a small group, I think that we could absolutely do that today. I do have a little bit of a presentation put together, but what I have to say is that I could talk about this topic literally for days and have talked about it for days. So
let me interrupt you already and say what you have up there has much wider applicability than that.
Say that again. You know, and so much, that's a great point, and so much about what is true about people with autism is true about people in the world. It absolutely is. And this is just, it's one of my favorite quotes because autism is such a big spectrum. And, you know, people come to me like I'm the autism expert, and I just think, I know a few people with autism. I know lots of people with autism now. But I still meet new people with autism every day, and they bring a new perspective to me because they are so different and so varied. And so I do love, Stephen Shore is an adult with autism, And many of the quotes, all of the quotes.
I want to go back to that.
Okay. Yeah.
Let's say that the other way.
If go ahead.
I've met one person with autism, I've met all people with autism.
Right. Right.
I mean, just how foolish does that sound when you say it out loud?
It does sound foolish. And yet, I think that I run into it all the time where people think they're experts. And I think that what it comes down to is really listening to the person themselves, the individual themselves.
I've met one person on food stamps, so I know everybody.
Exactly, exactly. Yes, yes. What I've learned in my 20 years doing this is to listen to the people on the spectrum. You know, when I started out in this field, I listened to the quote-unquote experts a lot more than I do today. You know, today I am listening to the people that are on the spectrum themselves because they are the ones who have taught me more than any one of those experts ever could with all of their degrees. And so all of the quotes that I have up here today come from individuals on the spectrum, just so you know. And then at the end, there's references in case you want to look them up for yourselves. But love that one. The other point that I want to make, and this speaks to that last quote very well, the language that we use, when I personally am talking about a person that has autism, I'm going to interchange these two. And so it's very political, I'll tell all of you guys. It's very political which term we use. So in the autism community, there is a group of folks on the spectrum who believe very, very strongly in the first one, in being an autistic person, that their autism is such a part of who they are that it actually is insulting to them to refer to themselves as a person with autism. There's another faction of people with autism that prefer to be called that prefer their personhood to come first. And this is the second one, really, the whole arena of people with disabilities. That's where that second one comes to, is a person first language, which again, if you're reading textbooks and you're learning from the experts, they tell you to use this person first, that you are absolutely that. But again, listening to the experts with autism, they're telling me, a lot of them are telling me they want to be called an autistic person. So in my presentation today, you will see both. And I wanted to honor that. I like to honor what people want to hear. And so you will hear me use both terms today. And I think, again, if you want to know how somebody wants to be referred to, ask that individual. That's what I do. I ask my friends, what would you prefer? Yes, go ahead.
I've also seen the third language where you use a very specific noun that applies to many classes.
Go ahead. Yeah,
if
like
someone is a neurotypical or a neuroatypical.
Yes.
Then you're using a single noun, and that noun is a subset of.
Absolutely, yes. And neurotypical is the next term I was actually going to bring up, so thank you for doing that. So neurotypical is what is considered people who are not on the spectrum. They are often called neurotypical. My friend Judy Endo, if you don't know Judy's material, I would highly recommend you look her up. So she is kind of our local Temple Grandin. She was born in Green Bay and lives now closer to here. She lives in Dane County. And she is a dear friend of mine. And she actually refers to people who are neurotypical as world people, quote unquote world people. So you might hear me say that too today.
What's her opposite to that? World people and
she prefers person with autism. That's what she says.
Okay,
that's what she calls herself.
Yeah, all right.
Mm-hmm. She's on the autism spectrum. And Judy has given me license to kind of share some of her stories with people. So she was an adult when she got diagnosed with autism. And what happened was she was in getting her son medically evaluated. And the doctor actually turned, after kind of recognizing what was going on for her son, turned to look at Judy and said, "Now what are we going to do about your autism?" And this is when she was about 50 years old. This happened, and before in her life, she had had countless other diagnoses, including schizophrenia, some pretty major mental health labels were applied to her at one point in her life. What's true is that Judy she's autistic, and she has written I don't even know how many books she's up to now, probably about 7 or 8 books on the subject. And so if you're looking, Endo, it's E-N-D-O-W. And if you ever have a chance to hear her speak, Judy, again, has taught me more than a lot of people put together. And she's local. So if you ever get a chance. But we're going to honor whatever the person with autism wants. So what do we know today? The numbers are kind of staggering, especially when I started in the field, the numbers were about 1 in 10,000 children. We count the children. I know there's adults with autism out there too. The CDC does counts of the children. So right now we are at 1 in 68 children in the United States being diagnosed as having an autism spectrum disorder. And that is the correct current terminology. So what used to be considered autism, Asperger's, pervasive developmental disorder is all now considered the autism spectrum. And this is how we, you know, how we diagnose using the medical diagnosis. And it does, it's reported in all groups of people that we see across the country. More than 5 times likely to occur in boys than it is in girls, though. That's true, too. And all of this is the kind of most recent data that we have on it. So causes of autism. There's not one known cause. And I want to really stress that. Because what I think the future is going to be, you know, in 20 years from now, what I think we're going to find is that there's actually different types of autism. And I think that research right now, you know, is going into typing
like
these
kinds of cancer.
Exactly. And I don't like to compare the two, but what's true is that in explaining the causes of autism, it's very much similar to causes of cancer.
Multiple causations,
genetic predispositions, absolutely. So it very much like that. And we're thinking that there are possibly environmental triggers. Again, very similar to how we think of cancer.
Are they looking into epigenetics for this?
Say that again?
Are they looking into epigenetics for this?
I don't know. Ask me that question in another way, maybe.
Well, so epigenetics has to do with methylation groups that control the expression of specific proteins on your gene.
Okay.
And what that means is that you can have things that appear sort of genetic but aren't genetic.
Okay.
And what they discover is that those methylation patterns, they are inheritable, but they're extra genetic. They're outside the genetic code. And so
environmental factors is, I think, what Janet is, for instance, getting at.
A bit more than
but
that.
But a tendency to develop something because of
Well, because these methylation groups are inheritable, and it's a method by which you can take.
So you inherit a tendency, and then based on your environment,
it gets triggered.
Whether or not that tendency is expressed or not, but
that makes a lot of sense. I don't actually know that specific the question to that specific that genetic. Question? I do know. Go ahead.
Scientific American article about that a year or so ago. I know it was touching on some of the aspects of that. It's too long ago. I don't remember.
Generally, when you see semi-inheritable, you think epigenetics.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do know what the numbers are. Is if one identical twin has autism, the likelihood that the other one will have autism is at about 90%.
Wow.
But it's not 100, right? So that's where we see these, you know, have, you know, the same genetic makeup, and you think it would be 100, and it's not. The likelihood, if you have one child in the family that has autism, that you'll have more kids, is it goes up to 1 in 10 instead of that 1 in, 64, what I just said.
I thought age of conception also factored into it.
Age of conception? Of the parent,
yeah. The age of the parent, right? Older males conceiving children.
That is absolutely one of the things that they're saying is linked.
These are all epigenetic hallmarks.
Mm-hmm.
That 1 in 10, I think you gave, that's very important.
Is it okay?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, so we know that we know that something is going on genetically. We know that for sure. Likely that we are going to find out that there are these triggers. I was just reading just before I got here that it might just be like how we are living today in the world is why this number has increased so much, because of everything that's around us, all of these things that we're putting into our bodies and on our foods. You know, it's likely that some of those things are the triggers that are causing us to see this huge, huge increase in the number of people diagnosed. Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, is that accounting for a number of people diagnosed in the sense that, like, we're just more sensitive to it now, or is it an actual increase?
That is a great question, and there is research on both sides of that. So there's research supporting the fact that we are just better at diagnosing. And people who, you know, might have just been thought of as quirky 20 years ago are now getting diagnosed as being on the spectrum. And then there's also a bunch of research saying that, no, this is actually happening more. There was an interesting article in that it came out of the research they did in England, where they studied the number of children being diagnosed with autism. And they found over there it was about 1 in 100. Equal to the number of adults diagnosed with autism. Again, they found it to be about 1 in 100, which meant that just those two populations, that it didn't seem like it was happening more, but we don't know. I mean, there's research on both sides of that. Yeah, I saw a hand up. Yeah.
I just remember recently I met a person, I can't quite remember her face, but she was probably around 8 years old.
Okay.
And she was an identical twin. And she told me at one point in our conversation she was missing her sister a lot. And I said, oh, what happened to your sister? And she said she died of cancer very, very young.
Oh.
And I asked her immediately, I said, I had never thought of it, but if you're identical twins, and if you're literally identical,
yes.
Why would one of you have a proclivity for cancer and not the other? And is that not also pointing to possible environmental factors?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, that's exactly what we're seeing in autism. Yeah.
And also, very subtle environmental factors. Twins raised in the same house.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Ghost in the Gene talks a lot about the epigenetics.
Ghost in the Gene?
Ghost, okay.
Ghost in the Gene.
Okay. I do not like that I still have to put this on my slides, but there's a lot of, if you go out into library books and you pull off old books off the library shelves, you know, they used to think, going back to the 40s and 50s, that it was poor parenting that was the cause, and I just still feel the need to put it up there just because we know that that is not what's going on anymore, but you still grab those old books and you just might see that, so I still like to include that in my slides. We are going to briefly, touch on some of the characteristics of autism. Just these three areas. So we're going to look at sensory, communication, and cognition, because I feel like those are the three that affect people with autism the most. So we're just going to go over those really quickly. And we're going to start with sensory processing. We already heard a little bit from Temple Grandin, just one more quote from her. Whatever the reasons, I, as an autistic person, reacted in a fixated behavior pattern in order to reduce arousal in my overstimulated nervous system. So we have what everybody knows of as kind of like your major five sensory systems that you learn in preschool. And then we have three more. Are people familiar with those three?
Not that much.
I have one person nodding. Okay. I want to tell you about those three because they are really important when it comes to autism. I think if you take anything out of this little half an hour together that we have, take this out, because this is like so important when you're thinking about supporting somebody, being in a relationship with somebody that has autism. So we have our five, and then we have our three more, which are called the hidden senses. So they're not the ones that are the most obvious. We have proprioception, which you guys got it. It lives where the kind of is sensed is in your muscles and your joints, okay? That's where the receptors are for proprioception. And it basically-
Is that like kinesthetics or something? You're aware that your hand, body, is
yes.
Like
yes, exactly. You know, it's like when you close your eyes and I can still touch my finger to my nose and I know where it is without looking or seeing, that's proprioception.
Okay.
Your body's getting information about where, your brain is getting information about where your body's at without you having to look at your body. So you know, when you're writing, you can probably write a few words without looking down and you'll know you've written the words you want to write. That's, if you can do that, that's because your sense of proprioception is giving you really good information, okay? Yeah.
Senses and whatnot coming from, like signals coming from your joints, or is that state being maintained in your brain about what the last position was?
So it's constantly getting that information from your muscles and your joints.
Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a great question though. Vestibular. So the next hidden sense is vestibular, and that sense actually gets information from your inner ear, and it's your sense of balance. So it's your sense that that when you're moving across a floor or a down steps, that gives your body information that helps you maintain upright position, a safe upright position. It's also very closely tied to your sense of sight. So your sense of sight also informs your vestibular sense quite a bit. And my favorite example of this is when you're sitting at a stoplight or a stop sign and you're in your car and you know you have your foot on the brake. Yeah, but somebody like in a truck, you know, slowly rolls by you and you all of a sudden jam on your brake harder. You feel like you're moving. That's your sense of sight kind of messing with your vestibular system a little bit. So that's vestibular. And your third sense, which is so new-ish that we are still debating what we're going to call it, entroception or introception. is we're debating what to call it, and then also some people just argue that this is really your sense of touch, but on the inside of your skin. So it's messages that are given from your bodily organs to your brain.
It might be subconscious.
What, say that again?
It might be subconscious.
Yeah, yes, it might be. It might be. But it also, you know, it's the sense, if you just kind of feel like you're getting sick and you can kind of tell before anything is really wrong.
I'm hungry.
Your sense of hunger, your actual sense of when you have to go to the bathroom. That's your sense of introspection working for you. Okay? Important, because people, over 90% of people on the autism spectrum report having differences in sensory processing. What that can look like is that can look like being oversensitive. So any one of these eight senses can come in too big. Okay? And especially your sense of proprioception, where your body's at, is one that really can get out of whack for some of our friends on the spectrum. The opposite can be true too. So sensations coming in too small. Again, I think about, if I'm going to give an example of that one, my sense of taste is coming in too small, and I still need that stimulation. All of us need a certain amount of stimulation to keep going in our day, right?
Hot sauce.
It's hot sauce. I know kids that have coffee grounds on everything. So we see lots of kids with autism that are eating things that might not be edible, and they might be seeking out some input to that sense of taste.
Did you say coffee grounds?
Coffee grounds.
Wow.
Yeah. Hot sauce. I mean, I've seen a lot of things.
I'm gonna try coffee grounds.
You're right. So that's the under-registering. That's like, okay, I need more input than the average person to get me to that same level. That's what that is. And so if you're just thinking about some of the unusual things Temple Grandin kind of mentioned doing, that we know folks with autism do, like line things up, maybe like fiddle with their hands, like, you know, the classic, if you think about classic autism, flapping hands, rocking in a chair, if you think about stuff like that. You know what we think that is really a way to control input. It really is. We used to, again, 20 years ago, we didn't realize how much meaning those behaviors had.
It's cutting down, if I'm doing something,
yes,
it's cutting down my other consciousness.
Exactly, 100%. It's a way to control the input. It's a way for me to get some control over what seems like a very, very, very chaotic, chaotic, hard world. And so that's why we think people do those things. Yeah.
I'm curious.
Yeah.
When I listen to music, I remember somebody commenting on the fact that even with, I guess, if I'm neurotypical,
yes,
neurotypical people, that if multiple senses are working at the same time, of course, the brain has to handle all of them, and it can distract from one of the senses you want to concentrate on. So for example,
yes,
when I go to concerts sometimes, even if people think I'm sleeping, I'm not, I'll close my eyes, because literally, I've actually tested this for myself, the minute I close my eyes when I'm at a concert, I sense that I'm hearing the music better. Meaning I can hear more detail in it.
Yes.
When my vision is working.
Yeah.
Have they done tests with people on the autism spectrum in terms of what happens when you shut down one sense completely, either put a blindfold on or stop the sound from coming in or anything?
I don't know if they've done research on that, but I know what adults with autism say about that.
Okay.
Is that for them, sometimes because this is so overwhelming, in their brain shuts it down for them.
Oh, really?
So it's what's called monochannel, if you're interested in looking it up. But what happens is, like, if I'm taking in information in all these senses and it's just too much, as the day goes on and these insults keep piling up in my brain, my senses start to drop out. And so at one point, I might not be able to feel where I'm. Proprioception is often the first one to drop out. I lose the sense of where my body's at, and often it starts in hands and feet. And so that's why you might start to see tapping of hands and feet, because you're trying to get that sensation back into your body. So oftentimes, this monochannel, what happens is people start to lose their senses, and they start to drop out one at a time, till eventually they're only taking in one sensory channel at a time. Happens. It happens often, I think, from in my experience with folks on the spectrum. And again, what we're doing right now is just listening to these, that's what I'm doing, is listening to these grown-ups talk and tell their story and tell what's really happening for them. Communication is the next area I wanted to just touch on. And I have a quote from Jim Sinclair for this one. "I simply didn't know what talking was for. Speech therapy was just a lot of meaningless drills and repeating meaningless sounds for incomprehensible reasons. I had no idea that this could be a way to exchange meaning with other minds." So what we know about communication in the spectrum is that this is where the spectrum truly, truly is a wide spectrum. You know, it can range for people that are nonverbal. The latest research I got on that is about 25% of the people on the autism spectrum are nonverbal. To people who are hyperverbal, and people who, I know a little guy who was able to alphabetize his little Sesame Street books. He had one for A, one for B, one for C when he was 2 years old. He could put them in ABC order and line them up. Very, very bright, very, very intellectually gifted, and very verbal. So we have that extreme when we're talking about the autism spectrum. People may require additional time to understand and respond to verbal input. And that is pretty much, you know, again, across the board, a lot of people with autism say that that's true for them. Temple Grandin, she talked about thinking in pictures. We're going to talk about that on the next slide too. But what's true is if your first language is actually pictures, which a lot of people with autism say their first language is not verbal, it's not these words that are coming out of my mouth right now, it's actually pictures. So if you are having to find a picture in your brain for every word that I'm saying, that can lead to what looks like a processing delay.
If pictures are in your head, that's how you think.
Yes.
How do you communicate that?
Well, sometimes you don't. I mean, sometimes you're nonverbal. And sometimes you have to find the right word to match the picture. And I'm going to use my friend Judy as an example here. And Judy is very bright. Like, Judy is very, very, she's way smarter than me. She's got a near perfect score on her ACTs when she took them. I can't speak to how smart she is. Because when I think about something like this and explaining this, it makes it seem like she's not that bright. And she is. So I want to tell people that when I'm telling these stories. But we were at a board meeting, an Autism Society Wisconsin board meeting one time, and there were snacks out on the table. And Judy picked up what looked like a bug that was like crawling on the table. And she picked it up and she got stuck. And she was holding in her hand and she said, "It's a bug, it's 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 a bug." In the meantime, I'm next to her trying to tell her that, you know, "Judy, it's not a bug." So I'm being verbal because I'm a verbal person. And I'm saying, "Judy, it's not a bug, it's not a bug." It was like a
piece of plastic?
It was a peanut, like a peanut skin, like not a peanut, but like the outside of a peanut, shell, but you know what I'm talking about. That's what it was.
Yeah, right.
But her head, she thought it was a bug. And so what was happening, we talked about it later, what was happening in her brain, she was going through every picture of a bug she ever had in her head, and she was trying to find a match. She was trying to find a match. In the meantime, I'm going, "Judy, it's not, you know," I'm verbally trying to give her this information. And she's trying to find the match. And so that's the struggle. I mean, that's a struggle about, like, if you think in pictures, what the world can be. We also have the very literal and interpretation of language, and I think that's because of that thinking in pictures. If I say, you have a chip on your shoulder and you have autism, you might look and see, like, what's on your shoulder. Is there a chip there?
True even if the person intellectually knew the expression chip on one's shoulder?
So once they intellectually know it, they won't make that mistake again.
They won't, okay.
Yeah.
But then it's hard to learn.
It is, well, because you don't know when you don't know it.
Right,
so,
okay.
You know, what Judy says is that we world people just make up so much of this stuff that doesn't make sense.
Meaning like chip on your shoulder?
Like chip on your shoulder.
Oh, yeah. Another example of that might be like if you're having a disagreement with someone who is on the spectrum and you say, "You know, I'm really upset because you said you were going to be here at 8 and you didn't come until midnight." If they came at 2 minutes to midnight, they're going to say, "That's not true. I because I'm going to be focused. You're saying,
absolutely.
You know, I'm saying, I mean, and you won't get anywhere with the discussion,
absolutely.
Because if you don't give the exact time they came in,
yes.
You know, they're just going to keep.
Yes.
You know, because
absolutely.
So yeah. So therefore, they didn't do it. They didn't break the rule because
yes.
they were yeah. yeah.
Yes. Yes. And Judy.
Oh yeah, but I bet the same thing can work the other way around. Somebody could just exaggerate time in the other way. Instead of a 2 minute difference, they thought it started out as half an hour.
Well, yeah, I mean,
my wife
yeah.
does that.
In regular conversation, it happens. But I'm saying that they really honestly. What I'm saying, they're not doing it to make a point.
Right.
They're not exactly doing it to make a point.
No.
They really don't understand what they did wrong because
exactly.
they didn't come in at
exactly.
midnight. They came in at 2 minutes to midnight. So they honestly don't understand.
Yes.
So
Judy.
It's not a matter of argument with them. It's that they literally don't understand.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, Judy was
yeah.
at Manna's, just here over here on the east side, and they offered her a bottomless cup of coffee. Okay, those of you who are thinking literally are getting it, okay? And she's like, why, you know, and she, again, being an adult, she's gotten a lot of, she's been bullied a lot in her life, I think, it's fair to say. And she thinks that somebody's playing a joke on her when they say, do you want a bottomless cup of coffee?
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, you're just going to pour it and it's just going to go through and get me, you know. And so Judy says, let me see the cup. She shows her the cup. She's like, yep, I'll take that. So we made a visual for Judy that just says bottomless cup equals free refills.
Yeah.
And now she gets it and she can laugh at it.
Yeah.
But before, like, there wasn't any way to, she didn't know. She doesn't know what she doesn't know, right?
Right.
So it's just so tricky. Yeah.
This sounds like an inability process metaphorical.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, because if your metaphors don't work if you think in pictures, they really don't.
Quite to literalism?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Very, very helpful.
Yeah.
Have you met any autistic people whose native language was other than English? Mm.
I have met some that are Spanish speakers, yes.
Do you know,
what about like Chinese?
Do they have the same issues
yes.
in all languages
mm-hmm.
with the metaphors in their own language?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's across the board. Yep. Yep.
Humans also make a lot of assumptions.
Yes.
Assumptions.
Yes.
Who does?
Humans.
Oh, humans. I've heard of them. Okay.
Yes. We do. We absolutely do. Cognition, really quickly. Paul McDonald was the one who, he said, when my mom moved the furniture in the house, I got very, very upset. I hated the change. I felt like I wasn't at home anymore. And we think that that is because of that thinking in pictures. If you have a picture of what home looks like.
Pictures of all the stuff.
Yeah. If I have kids that will tell me, you know, when I get a haircut, that I look so different that they're not sure it's me anymore. Because it just doesn't match. Again, think about those pictures matching. So we also have this neurology that doesn't always allow for automatic integration of information. So if I learn something new today, and I take it in and I'm processing it, and then I automatically in my brain, it gets filed in a number of different spots. So maybe if I learn something when I'm talking about genetics, then I'm gonna file that. It might go under, ooh, I need to look that up. It might go under genetics, it might go under autism. It's automatically going in a few different places in my brain. That doesn't necessarily happen for people with autism.
Yeah, there's a lot of us that you see something and then you didn't make the connection someplace else until it got explicitly pointed out.
Sure, I mean, that's exactly, yeah.
I can think of examples.
Yeah, yeah. And Judy, the way Judy talked about it was when she learned information, mm-hmm. it was on an island in her brain.
Yeah.
Is this, okay,
yeah,
this is feeling true.
Resonates.
And she actually had to think about bridges to build that new information to other islands. She had to make herself think that way to make things connect. Whereas I think for world people, I'm going to speak for world people right now, it just automatically kind of happens. So that's why I think generalization of skills can be complicated. I've made this mistake before. You know, you're teaching a child a new skill and you teach them in one place in one way and then they can only do it in one place in one way and can't do it at school and can't do it wherever they're going. And the other thing, sometimes I have difficulty seeing the big picture. And I'd like to say this is a difficulty, but I also think it's a gift. Because the gift is, the details, I think, for some people with autism are so fascinating that they really get caught up in those details and are really deep thinkers. You know, so if we have, I think that I'm a more broad thinker. I think about lots of different things. I don't have the brain that has a propensity to get lost in those deep, deep details. And people on the spectrum tend to have that. That's just, you know, how they think is they get really deep about stuff. Yeah.
I just want to make two comments, and I'm going to make them as quick as I can. They're related.
Yes.
The first is I would really like to see research, and I've looked and looked and looked for research. There was an organization doing research about 10 years ago, and that website is now gone, of adult children that were raised by people that, with that were on the autism spectrum, especially when they were never diagnosed. We're talking about
sure.
people my age,
right.
parents, you know, were born in the 10s and the 20s,
yep.
you know, and were never diagnosed. I was on an internet board like 10 years ago with a group of about 30 of us from all over the world. Most of us were women, and we almost all had fathers that were on the spectrum,
okay.
And pretty severely on the spectrum. And the similarities between us in terms of because these people were never diagnosed, okay?
Sure.
And high conflict households as a result, you know,
yeah.
was really, really negative, you know, and we had life stories that were almost the same. I mean, we had the same diagnoses as adults, you know, mental health diagnoses.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there was damage. I mean, I'm not blaming it on, you know, I'm saying that back then they didn't know.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
And to be raised by a parent who doesn't make eye contact, who doesn't have empathy when you're crying, who, you know, that has lifetime effects.
Absolutely.
And I'm really surprised that there's not more, you know, not more effort to reach out to those people. Because for, you know, hundreds of years, you know, these people lived and breathed and had children and a lot of times married other people with,
yes.
you know.
Yes.
So people were raised with two, you know,
mm-hmm.
or in another case, my other parent just checked out emotionally, you know. So
yeah.
That has a huge impact on a child.
Absolutely.
The second thing is just that my father was born in the 20s, and I didn't even know that there was such a thing as autism spectrum disorders until I happened to see a book in the 90s. And I happened to open up a page, and there was an article on Asperger's, and there was a list of 20 characteristics. And I broke into tears, bought the book, took it home, made a Xerox, sent it without any note or anything to my mother. She called me 2 days later when she got into the mail, sobbing on the phone, and she said, "This is your father. This explains everything. He did love us after all."
Amazing.
Because we just thought that he didn't care about us. We
yeah.
thought that he was a bad person. We thought that he was, you know, that. And so the last 10 years of his life, you know, I never like told him, "Hey, Dad, you know,
yeah.
have this."
Yeah.
You know, because he was by that time, he was so set in his ways. He was in his 80s. You know, nothing ever would have, you know, he was right about everything anyway. But it helped so much with my forgiveness of him to know that he didn't purposely emotionally neglect us. He didn't
right.
purposely do that.
Right.
And the other good thing I wanted to point out was, even though it must have been really, really hard to grow up at a time when no one knew anything about autism, and I'm sure that he got made fun of, and I'm sure that he got punished and everything growing up.
Yes.
On the other hand, he grew up at a really good time, because one skill that he really had was mechanical. He was never good at like computer stuff, but he was good at mechanical. And he was able to go get a job as a movie projectionist, where he was in a booth and working with a projector, and he was very proud of his job. And at that time, he had a union job. He was able to support us. We had a nice house in the suburb.
Mm-hmm.
We had two cars, vacations in the summer. We had this nice middle class life.
Yeah.
And I think if he was coming out now, you know, because he was pretty, he was very, very disabled by, I mean, he was on,
mm-hmm.
on the very severe end, you know. He could not get along, he could not have gone to job interviews, he could not have had a resume, he could not have coped in the kind of world that we have today. And now the jobs that he did well are all minimum wage.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
he retired well, you know.
Yeah.
If he had been 50 years, 40 years younger, he probably would have lived in poverty. And it's really, I mean, I'm so glad that he just barely escaped that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was valued. He
absolutely.
Had a value to society. society.
Mm-hmm.
And he would not have that value today.
I think you're right. Yeah. And I think that the other point that you're making that needs to be made is just, we need to, you know, we focus a lot on people on the spectrum, but we also need to focus on the people in their lives. And I think that I'm very involved in the state organization, the Autism Society of Wisconsin. And I think that we are working to do that more because that's been a population that we have not, we just haven't given services to, we haven't given attention to. And I think we just need to do that. Absolutely. And what may be true is that, you know, your dad may have, you know, I'm thinking that he felt, you know, empathy towards you, and he felt, but I think
he did, but he didn't know how to show
exactly.
It. Exactly. He had no way to know
that. And that's a big myth. It's a big misconception is that people on the autism spectrum, you know, don't want relationships and can't feel empathy, and that's not, in fact,
true.
A lot of people are telling us that they're actually over emotion, they over sense emotions of the room, they can over kind of feel that stuff, and that becomes too much for them to handle, too. And so I think, you know, we have to dispel some of these myths as well.
And because if you grew up that way and you don't know, you're in an era like I was where the idea didn't even exist.
Yes. Yeah.
You have no other choice than to believe that you're not loved, you're not cared for.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean,
absolutely.
You know, and that's the way we all grew up in our generation.
Yeah.
You know, with
yeah.
So,
yeah. Okay. I have on here my. Whoops. Am I going the wrong way? One more. My email. I know we took some questions now, but if you have questions later, you don't hesitate to email me. I'll do my best to answer them. Are there any other questions? I saw Naomi came back in. Are there any other questions at all? Yeah.
About one thing, and I don't know anything about the condition, but there was a term that used to be used, which I'm under the impression is no longer politically correct, obviously.
Okay.
Idiot savant.
Yeah.
Number one, is there any relation between that and autism? And number two, I saw a guy on YouTube. He's British. He's about 30. And apparently, I don't know if he's considered autistic.
Okay.
He used the term idiot savant.
Yes.
I don't know if he's autistic. I'm curious if you think he is. He, in terms of many skills, is clearly far behind what we would typically call an old person,
sure.
An average person.
Sure.
But he has this visual memory that's absolutely amazing. They flew him over London, where he lived, and they gave him a sheet of paper about 25 feet long
mm-hmm.
that they posted on the wall.
Yeah.
And he started drawing all the buildings, all the
trees,
all the
every,
cars,
every leaf.
They
every
said
leaf.
He made a few mistakes, but very few. They flew
right.
over Rome, wherever the Colosseum is.
Yes.
And he drew the entire Colosseum with all the columns. They said he was off by like two columns, but pretty much everything was correct. And what was so strange is people thought he was not because they said, when I saw the city, it didn't look like that, but they forgot is he was looking at it from a helicopter. Where
sure,
was
sure.
And when they checked it from a helicopter, everything was accurate.
Right.
Is that autism or is that something different?
My educated guess would be that he was on the autism spectrum.
Okay.
And about 10% of the people on the autism spectrum have some sort of savant quality.
Okay.
And we won't call it, what did you say?
Idiot savant.
Anymore. But savant, absolutely. Right. And so again, but people make the assumption that everybody that has autism then has these gifts. And it's about 10% of people that have some sort of gift.
Okay.
Whether it be, you know, I think about Rain Man again from when I was growing up and he counted all the toothpicks on the floor, or the ability to draw, or you know, you're being a musician. So there's some folks on the spectrum that actually see music in colors.
Yeah.
Synesthesia. Yes. Thank you. You could come up here and do this one. synesthesia is when information's coming in one of those senses, but it's kind of getting processed in the brain. It's coming out another one, and people, you know, that makes for I think very interesting. People see in colors. You know, my friend Judy sees, what I would best describe as auras. That's the word that I know how to use, but kind of like light surrounding people. She sees in colors, and by those colors, that's how she interprets intent.
Well, numbers sometimes, like
numbers,
color seeing, is blue.
Numbers and colors, yes.
Six is orange, and that's how they do their math.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's a very
absolutely.
Limited amount of evidence that there's cross-wiring in the brain between the various sense centers that the synesthetes are crossing.
Yes.
And
yes.
Listening to Temple's description, it sounds very much like she has her language center has some cross-wiring. And that seems common in several of the stories I read, but I
yes.
don't want to reach conclusions on the amount of data I've got.
I don't have a number for people that experience synesthesia. I don't have that percentage, so I don't know that either. But I know it's much more, it's not uncommon in autism, where it is very uncommon in the general population. It's not that normal for world people.
There's very strong correlation.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, a couple
of questions. On adults and adolescents being diagnosed. I have met some people that are on the spectrum that say that they were diagnosed because, you know, they knew they were having problems with people, they have problems understanding.
Sure.
When they got diagnosed. That kind of blows me away because, like, my dad never even would have asked the question. You know, all of his life, he thought that, you know, everyone else was just out to get him. It never occurred to him to say, you know, is
yes.
there something wrong in the way that I...
Yes.
So how is it that people that lack insight are able to have enough insight to realize that they lack insight? And come to you?
It's a great question and really hard.
I don't think that often they do. I think that often it's happenstance where they happen upon a book and they're like, this is me, or you're at a doctor.
Recognize themselves, they would need to. My dad would never recognize himself from a description of.
So, you know, what happened for Judy, and I don't know if anybody else wants to speak for their experience, is she was given a list of things, and it felt like it was a closer match than anything else had ever been before. And so she was able to kind of like to see herself in that.
She perceived that she was lacking in certain ability, you know, because that's what I'm getting at. Is
yes.
If you don't even realize that you're lacking in the ability, how do you even, you know?
Well, it's an inference of conditions. So you basically read the description, you say, wow, those three really resonate with me. And then you have to think about the other seven, because mm-hmm. they might not resonate at first. Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, there's just so many factors involved in how introspective a person natively is.
Yeah, it might just be... You might just have an introspective personality.
Absolutely, period. Absolutely.
And you're going to be more introspective
yes.
than somebody on the spectrum who doesn't have that.
Right.
Independent
okay. right.
of spectrum, humans are enormously
exactly.
variable.
Exactly. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So correct. I'm just
yeah.
going to wrap this up, but I think
yeah.
Sharon can stick around
I can.
Afterwards.
Yes.
Thank you so
but
much
we can,
for coming.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. Yeah.
You know, let people be who they are and don't assume malicious intent and don't impose, you know, your normal worldview, because people process things differently for all sorts of different reasons, and that's valid and that's true. So those are my thoughts.
Yes.
We'll see you guys in 2 months, but the potluck, March 18th.